Our next presentation is Integrative Health Interview Series, IHIS, a free online data resource for teaching U.S. public health and statistics. And our presenter today is Dr. Miriam King, who has a PhD in demography and has been working on the IHIS project for the past 7 years, focusing on data harmonization, documentation, user support, and outreach. She also has 10 years' experience working on NIH and NSF-supported data harmonization projects at the Minnesota Population Center, including creating an integrated version of the U.S. March Current Population Survey in contributing to the creation of integrated samples of U.S. and international censuses and the American Community Survey. So welcome.
Okay, I have nothing to disclose except this was also, in terms of the presentation, the principal investigator of this project is Professor Lynn Blewett at the University of Minnesota, and there are also no relations to disclose for Lynn. So I need to start by telling you what IHIS is, and after I do that, I'm going to go on to talk about some ways that this user-friendly database has been used in the classroom by graduate students and undergrads, talk about some features that we're working on adding that will make it more user-friendly to teachers in particular. And I would love, after this presentation, to follow up with any of you who think you might be interested in integrating this into a training program. I think it could work any level from high school on. And also, we have an exhibit booth here under the Minnesota Population Center near the CDC exhibit at the exhibitor hall, so feel free to stop by and I would be happy to demonstrate the website and talk to you more about the project also. So one way to explain what IHIS is that it's integrated in the sense that we have taken public data across many years and made it more consistent, giving variables consistent names, codes, and documentation across time. It's a health database with information about health behaviors, health conditions, healthcare access, and healthcare use. It's an interview-based data set based on a large in-person household survey. It has a good response rate partly because an interviewer shows up at the house, and it's harder to say no to somebody who's sitting in your living room than it is to hang up on them. And it's a series. It's particularly designed to make it easy to pool data across time to look at long-term trends in something. And it is microdata. It's data on individuals enumerated within their families and the data about those individuals. The source data for the Integrated Health Interview Series is the public use files of the U.S. National Health Interview Survey, which is the longest running health survey in the United States and, in fact, in the world. It's been fielded every year since 1957, and the data have been saved since 1963. So we make available data from 1963 up through 2010. It has the slogan, Monitoring America's Health, and believe me, it earns that slogan. There's hardly a topic relating to individual or public health that is not covered by that survey. And it is a fabulous data source. It might seem like, why are we doing this? The National Center for Health Statistics fields this data, and they make public use files available, and they're great. But there are some limitations in terms of the data that we start with, especially limitations that make it hard for researchers or students to analyze data across multiple years. So it's the strengths, it's very easy to list those. It's a large nationally representative survey. It does not cover people who are in the military or who are institutionalized, but it is a representative national survey for the total population of the U.S. otherwise. It covers health status, health behaviors, and health care. There is quite consistent core content in terms of some variables, like there's always race, age, sex from the early 1970s. There's self-reported health status, insurance coverage, and so on. And then other topics come and go from year to year. So for example, in 2010, the public use file covered cancer control and epidemiology, cancer testing, diet, exercise, cancer family history. That kind of question has been asked every 5 years. Other years, they might do complementary and alternative medicine. The data that's currently in the field, they're collecting a lot of information about disability. So you can't study necessarily every variable every year, but periodically the same topics come up. It's the major source for tracking progress toward Healthy People 2020. More data comes from NHIS than any other source for that. It's suitable for studying health disparities. Along with the health data, there is data about race, ethnicity, immigrant status, whether one lives inside or outside a metropolitan area, education, family income, occupation, and so on. And if you looked at all the samples from 1963 to the present, it covers 5 million people, about 100,000 people in a single year. But as I say, there are some problems, which is why the National Institutes of Health gave us money to make it easier to work with. If you go to the original files, there's just so many files. There are over 500 files to begin with. There are over 50,000 variables in this original source data. The documentation for a single year might run to thousands of pages. There are subtle changes across year to year in terms of who was asked the question, how the question was asked, the variable categories available, the names of variables. An example I often use is there's a commonly used question on, have you ever smoked 100 cigarettes in your life? And that's been asked about 30 years, but it's had 11 different names, and it comes and goes, and it's in different files, and it's just hard for people to find it in the original data. And the sample design changed some. And the agency itself is always, it really has a mission of collect the data for this year, plan for next year, do the reports on the most recent year, move on. And we felt that this is a wonderful resource that exists for many years, and let's make it easier for researchers to use multi-year and trend analysis especially. So before we got funding, we looked at the literature that was published using the National Health Interview Survey and found that it was almost never used for more than 1 year or more than 3 years at max. It doesn't seem to have been used a lot as a teaching tool, except at very maybe in some graduate classes. And so we were trying to make it just easier for researchers and teachers. So you don't need to know everything that we do behind the scenes to make it easier, but we put together the data into one big file per year. We create consistently coded variables. Currently there are 12,000 consistently named and consistently coded variables. And we do that without losing information, and I'll do a little example of how we do that. We write online variable-specific documentation. The original data kind of laid out as if you think that someone wants to think about data for a particular year, but often researchers are interested in a topic rather than a year. They want to know about obesity, or they want to know about smoking, or they want to know about diabetes, and they want to know every year it's available and maybe trace trends and disparities over time. So that's how we organize the documentation. And we have a data extract engine that allows a researcher who's comfortable using a statistical package to select the years and variables that they want and get a custom-made ASCII file that includes just that, along with a SPS SEDA and or SAS codebook, or for researchers who want very quick results, or in classroom use. For high school students, for undergraduates, for beginning students in public health, there's an online tabulator that's very user-friendly where you can make a table in a snap to look at trends or differentials for a variable. I just want to emphasize again that the number of topics covered by the National Health Interview Survey is kind of mind-boggling. Thinking about, for example, our first presentation that we heard today, many of the things that the students were interested in, like obesity, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, asthma, cancer, etc. Just about everything that came up there, I thought, they could use IHIS for some of this. And the one thing I need to say is a limitation of the data is it's really a national database. Only 4 big census regions are identified. So if you really wanted to know about Brooklyn, or you really wanted to know about South Carolina, this would not necessarily be the place to go for that specific data. But if you wanted to put what was happening nationally into a context for what was happening in Brooklyn or South Carolina, students could easily look at this database to get a sense of national figures and see, are we doing better or worse, or and so on. Now, this is an example of how we display the data. So this is our to access the data, this is variables included in general health status. If there's an X, it means it's available for that year. And so you can see some variables are available only for a few years, other variables are available for multiple years. A researcher or a teacher doesn't have to go through mounds of documentation to see, oh, what years is that available? So something like self-reported health status or bed days per year or BMI or whatever, you can see right there. Our documentation is variable-specific, as I said, so it tells what year something was available, who answered the question in every year, which does change over time, what weight to use with a variable. You can click on that link for survey text and pull up what the question wordings for every year, and we provide a description of the variable and some warnings about if there are comparability issues over time, so people don't make unintentional errors in, you know, comparing apples and oranges. At least they're making an informed choice if they group things that have a little change. And here's an example of a variable where I say we make things comparable over time without losing information. One option would be to go the least common denominator. But, for example, the race variable in the National Center for Health Statistics in the earliest years was black, white, other. And that is not a degree of detail that is acceptable to most researchers today. And then as things moved forward, there were more categories distinguished. Some years distinguished more categories than others. So if you look, for example, at the first digit, say the 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., groups together things that are consistent across all years or almost every year. So every Asian and Pacific Islander group gets a 4 in front. But in some years, Chinese and Filipino were specifically distinguished, and the trailing digits allow you to identify that. So we don't lose information, but we make it relatively easy to combine across years. Okay, so the data have been available for a few years now. We're funded by a grant from the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development, and we're in our just started our 8th year of this project. We ask people when they apply to use the data, and it's all free. It's all available online. It's everybody's tax dollars at work. We find that it's used currently more by students than by anybody else, grad students in particular. And the largest users are in public health, followed by public policy, clinical medicine, some of the social sciences. So when people fill out this registration form that we need them to do so we know who our audience is and we know where to send their data to and their password, we ask them how they intend to use the data, what institution they're at, et cetera. And this is some information that just from that I was able to collect as part of what we routinely collect. So for grad students, students at 80 institutions are using this in the classroom. About 40% of the graduate student users are using it for a class assignment, and most of those assignments are for classes in public health, but also in statistics and clinical medicine and some social sciences. For the undergraduate students, 43 institutions students say they're using it in the classroom. And those, almost 70% are using it for a classroom assignment. And it seems to be used kind of evenly between public health, economics, and statistics classes. Now, some of the advantages for using this in the classroom, again, big sample sizes, nationally representative, very broad, intuitive subject matter. If you want to know what are trends and differentials in diabetes by race and income status, or how much do people exercise and how does that change over the course of the age lifespan or something. I mean, these are variables that are not only really important in terms of public policy and public health, but they're things that people can really relate to as interesting subject matter. We did this project to make it easy to study trends and relatively easy to study disparities with race, income, immigrant status, Hispanic ethnicity, education, etc. variables. It's flexible in terms of what the skill level of the students need to be. Students who know how to use the statistical package can do that, but I've taught this in a summer public health course where some of the students were entering with no training in terms of using data analysis or statistical analysis, like starting their MPH after doing vet school, for example. And they were able to find a topic that interested them and do an interesting paper or PowerPoint presentation just using the very user-friendly online tabulator. So it's very quick to learn, and I would say I'd love to hear that it was being used in some high school programs, for example. It allows the researcher or the student, they don't have to focus on managing files or tracking down variables. It lets you really focus on the questions and the methods you want to use and get right to the interesting part rather than, concatenating your files. And it's free, available online, and there is user support, so anyone who has any problems can email us, and a person, probably me, will follow up and help them sort out the problem. And I would love to partner with some people using this in training at the high school or undergraduate level in particular, and see if I could help you figure out some ways to use it in the class. We know if it's been used in some public health courses, public policy courses. Microeconomics professors have used it for students to use their research papers. Sociology instructors have used it as an example of complex survey data and suitable methods for that. So you can use it either to kind of teach methods or statistics or a substantive public health topic. And we're adding some new features to the web. To me, it sounds great that there's 12,000 variables. But that can be really daunting. And so we're going to put on some new features of examples of use in the classroom, highlighting particular key variables like those that are used for measuring healthy people 2020 or good variables for using to track health disparities and so on. So rather than having to kind of swim through the whole website, you can go to an area that's really for teachers and students to find like kind of key variables and key indicators. And create some more user-friendly things like online tutorials with Camtasia on how to use the website. I'm old, I can read a long document. A student wants to go right to the YouTube kind of format. And that's our plan for the future. And again, I'd love to talk to any of you about this more after this or at the booth and do some partnering if you see some ways you might use this in the classroom. Thank you very much.
Well, we have plenty of time for questions and answers, and I'm actually going to pull up the last slide so that this gets recorded too for people who want to. Okay, do we have any questions for our panelists?
I'm particularly interested in how you reach the high school students. So those of you who, when you reached the high school students, did they have any clue of the word public health? Because we're working on a public health training center grant and trying to reach high school students. We know that they're given a lot of information about medical careers, about MD, maybe vet school, like you said, or others. But we're really wondering, do they understand the word or public health careers? It sounds like some of you have worked with the high school students.
So for the Health Science Academy, one of the things that we were very careful about in the academy is to expose the students to different public health careers and different choices when they're pursuing a career in health. And so at SUNY Downstate Medical Center, the campus that they come to once a week during their time at the Health Science Academy, we expose them to various schools within SUNY Downstate. So there's a School of Health Careers Opportunity. So they get occupational therapy exposure, physical therapy, and so they have a broad range in terms of how they think about health. And then with the internship, that has actually helped them in terms of seeing some of the things in the site, out in the community as well.
From my understanding, students were recruited through the Upward Bound programs at high schools. So I'm not certain if that particular program even introduces students to public health. So I'm assuming, and Dr. Glover might be better positioned to respond to this question, but as students were approached about participating in this program, I would guess the question is, well, what is health, public health?
Right.
Is that medical? Is it clinical? And I think that the conversation probably snowballed from there.
In working with Upward Bound, that was in interest of the coordinators for that program. To be able to integrate public health as one of the components of the Upward Bound program. That allowed us to build on what they already had in place. So public health became one of the components of the Upward Bound program. So starting with an introduction to what is public health.
Right. Yeah, we're getting the sense that guidance counselors don't really have a sense of public health versus, you might want to go to dental school or you might want to do this, but some at the high school level are not quite there, but that's interesting about the Upward Bound. Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Did you
have a question for Lorna Frazier-White reference? The tracking of the students, and because of the model that you have, the community engagement approach, and engaging having the borough president's office as a part of the consortium. Is there a way for students to be a part of any type of community advisory committee or board at that level?
Yeah, okay. One of the things that we would like to implement going forward, right now the students are not involved in terms of a community advisory board, but going forward we're hoping to have funding to continue the program moving forward. And we would like to have that as a part of it, that they can be a part of the community advisory board, because I think that their voice is important too with the other organizations.
I think I saw him back there. Go ahead.
For Miriam, when you talked about the correlation between low income and then seeing when diseases come up, can you do the same in the program with types of professions and diseases that may be associated with
it? The occupation, there are variables on occupation and industry that are in the data. There is a very great concern on the part of the National Center for Health Statistics, which collects the individual data, about protecting respondent confidentiality. And so in some of the, up to about 2002, I think, they provided most of the categories that occur in the Census Bureau and Census publications. And for 2002 forward, they grouped into smaller categories. So it's really, you could perhaps see, is someone working in industry, or are they working in, say, fishing and lumbering and agriculture or something like that. But if you wanted to look at nurses with the most recent data, for example, that would be, you'd pretty much have to go to a restricted data center. We have thought about, and so I would say that the occupation of data for the most recent years, because they've grouped it, is really maybe better an indicator of socioeconomic status than exposure to risk. They do have some, if you're interested in occupational health for particular variables or particular topics, in 2010 they asked for dermatitis, asthma, and carpal tunnel syndrome, a range of questions about whether people got the condition related to their job and their past job and what job it was and so on. And some years they've asked about, say, exposure to dangerous working conditions or noxious chemicals or whatever. They have some questions about do you work with or volunteer in a healthcare setting, and do you work directly with patients? So for specific things, you may be able to do it, but unfortunately, there's not as much occupational detail as I would like. And again, anyone is welcome to email me. I have some of my cards as well as the flyers if there's a particular topic that you're interested in. I know the data pretty well. And so I might be able to give you some help in terms of a topic like occupation and health.
Okay, so I have one more question. I know you brought up that there is no information on military personnel. Is that because the military and government has their own data set?
I think it's because the agency was tasked with the collects the data, the National Center for Health Statistics was tasked initially with collecting data about the civilian population. And that's just carried through. It's kind of the same way the current population survey collects information about, you know, the civilian working force and so on. There are a number of other surveys done at the National Center for Health Statistics. National Center for Health Statistics, where I know that they collect information about the institutionalized population, and there may be some, there are probably some specialized health surveys that I don't personally know that are for the armed forces. You do know veteran status, when people served in the armed forces, whether or not they were honorably discharged, sometimes you know whether or not they got care in a VA facility. So you can study people, you know, once they've left the armed forces.
Other questions? We'll go here and then there. Go ahead.
So it's pretty easy to manage testing sets. Do you give instructions somewhere on?
Yeah, our website has, you know, kind of a step-by-step guide how to do that. We are actually have figured out how to send people directly SAS, SPS, or STATA files, but we're working out the legal implications of doing that. So we hope that eventually we'll be able to do that. Currently, you get an ASCII file and a code book for each of the major statistical packages. And there's a place you can go on the website that's basically step-by-step how to do this. And if you run into problems, you can email us, and somebody will follow up until you've succeeded. So.
Yeah, I have a question about the FEA, kind of a two-part question. One is in terms of the practicality of it. You know, if somebody at another university were looking to partner with the local health department to have a similar program, what would be some maybe practical advice you would give? And would you see it, you did it with graduates, but would you also see this being able to use with undergraduate population?
I think it's really practical. I mean, we are always happy if you want to email me. We have sort of like a protocol that we develop that goes step by step exactly what you need to do to start a program, which we share with a lot of folks. You know, you just sort of need a coordinator, in a sense, on the academic side, who can be the person who kind of gets requests and decides, well, is this a legitimate request for Team FEA? We don't want them sort of doing people's gut work that they just can't get to. So one of the things, like that we said, is we really don't like them to do data analysis unless they can be part of the data collection or part of maybe giving a presentation about the data, because we don't want it to be seen as sort of, you know, oh, we'll analyze all your data for you. But we have those documents available. We have used undergraduates on a very limited basis. I do a lot of the Team FEA activities where we actually take students, like she said, I take students to Katrina and Wilma and Irene, and mostly we do graduate students because our university's council has advised us in terms of liability and things. But we also have those documents that we can share with you as well. So. And that sometimes depends on a case-by-case basis. Either the local health department or the state health department wants them to sign. You know, they need to at least be 18 because they need to be able to sign like a confidentiality agreement or something like that with the health department.
Other questions?
Yes. I have a question for Dr. Fraser and White. I work with high school students at the Chicago Public School. To help coordinate their public health club. And I was wondering, with the health disparities curriculum that you guys were using for your program, is it available somewhere, or do you have suggestions as to how me as a graduate student, being my first year, learning more about public health myself, how to incorporate what I'm learning and also other resources to provide them with proper information?
It's a big question. our curriculum, we haven't published it yet, but I could give you think that I could talk to you about different things that we have done in terms of informing the curriculum and the kinds of things that the students would need. We did do some focus groups, finding out what the students wanted and what the community also wanted when we were informing the curriculum for the students, as well as working with faculty and in terms of what are some of the key things that we wanted to talk to them about. But one of the big issues that we really wanted to address were the social determinants of health, making sure that students know that, you know, health is not just disease specific, and there are so many social factors that play into that. And so that's something that I think you should incorporate, you know, thinking about all the different aspects and all the different factors that go into determining how your health outcome is. So even looking at that and starting there, and even thinking about what are some of, when you think about disease specific, because our students want to go into health professions, and what are some of the illnesses and what are some of the clinical aspects that they can talk about and they can get more information about. When we talk about cardiovascular disease, making it more interactive, even a lot of students, we were surprised, that actually do read food labels right now, and knowing what BMI is or what their waist circumference. So those kinds of things, and knowing that, you know, childhood obesity is such it's such a big health issue, and keeping those kinds of things that are on their top priorities being a part of the curriculum that you're developing.
Other questions? Yes.
I know a lot of this is focused as U.S. Focused work, but I do a lot of work in developing countries, and I'm curious to know, in the development of your systems and approaches, if you've come across other comparable or similar kinds of approaches in developed or less developed countries. And I guess the second question would be, do you see any, how do you see the usability or transferability of some of the approaches and systems that you have for less developed countries?
Okay, so I'll start. So what I think that I mentioned, our CEO is replicating our program in Trinidad and Tobago, right? And so I'm thinking about how we would like that to set up that model. So thinking that, yes, we need an academic partner and a University of the West Indies that's a prime academic partner that takes the place kind of SUNY Downstate Medical Center. Finding out what are various community-based organizations, or in the West Indies you have non-governmental organizations or NGOs, and so thinking about how do you come together and marry those groups and bring them together at the same table to advise or inform something that may be an adaptation or a replication. And then thinking about students and what are the key things that you want those students to learn, and what are the things that they do want to learn. The students may want to inform that curriculum. So we are at that process now where we're having students' input from the West Indies, and also just taking the model in terms of having NGOs be our community-based organizations, working with ministries of health and various ministries in the West Indies compared to over here. We didn't have to do different departments, so that's something different over there. But having a partner on the ground that you can talk to and kind of like create something, or tell them what you're planning and seeing where things need to be taken away and where things need to be added, that's important.
In terms of international data, we do have a large project funded by the National Science Foundation and with some money from NIH that is disseminating anonymized samples of census data. We currently are disseminating data from 65 countries, going back sometimes as early as the 1960s up to the latest census rounds, and almost 200 census samples. And for low-resource countries, there are often more health-related questions than you might find in, say, the U.S. Census. So on disability, cause of disability, sometimes on nutrition, deaths in the past year, births in the past year, and so on. And I would be happy to talk to anybody about that. That is free for nonprofit use. So most of our data, anybody can use, including, you know, people from a corporation. Those data are disseminated with the understanding that it's for teaching, research, or policy only.
But it is the same general logic of how it's done for comparison across countries or across time within a country. And we recently had a grant proposal approved to do the same sort of approach for DHS data, demographic and health survey data, for African countries. So I hope to come back in about 2 or 3 years with word on that. And I would say in terms of an issue for us, we do, you know, disseminate the data through an internet connection at the University of Minnesota is where our servers are. It can be a challenge for people in less developed countries to have a reliable internet connection. So sometimes what we need people to do is just email us that they've registered and they've been approved and what they want, and we can send them a CD with the data downloaded or the SAS or SPSS or data files. I think that's a really, you know, big challenge that I wasn't all that cognizant of until recently, of how just like staying online long enough to get a data extract can be a problem. People can have great skills once they've got the data, but it's an issue. IPUMS, IPUMS International.
I believe in trying to adapt or replicate a program such as the co-op program, it really depends on the partnerships that are available in that particular area, as well as the existing challenges in that area. Certainly, every developing country will not necessarily be interested in maybe developing minority practitioners of public health, maybe not even health disparities, but I think that looking at the areas, the problems that plague that area, and just trying to see how we could rise to the challenge of addressing the challenge will depend on that area. And again, developing countries, of course, how can you sustain an internet connection in many of these places? So I would suggest a web-based program if that infrastructure is in place, which would, I think, be a great idea. But again, the funding for such a thing may become an issue.
Yeah, and I mean, I think our model similarly works. I mean, anywhere that you have students and local or regional or ministry level, you know, people who need search capacity, which they certainly do. So.
Other questions?
Comment, reference that question. I think that when we're looking at any community and wanting to engage that community, it's about community-based interdisciplinary research. That research can be even identifying what the issues and problems are. How you go into an area or a community or a country involves what I've heard the panelists say, identifying the resources, the assets, the key stakeholders, and bringing them to the table at the very beginning to get a good understanding of what the needs are, and then finding out from them what's the best approach
to make this
happen. And I think that's what I'm hearing, and what I'm, you know, what really excites me about the work that I'm hearing about across universities and communities is the fact that we are recognizing the value that communities bring to initiatives, and then using that to build strong programs that lead to improve policies, improve health status at the community level. So, yeah.
Anyone else? Well, if not, please join me in giving another round of applause for the presenters. They did a great job. And thanks again to all of you for coming.